This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Co-sponsoring tonight is the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum, Kevin O'Malley, chair. Our program tonight is Worldwide Challenges and the Environment, Difficult Necessary Dialogues, with Dr. Les Wong, who's president of the San Francisco State University. It is my pleasure to introduce Carrie Curtis, who will introduce Dr. Wong. Carrie is a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and a leader for our Environment and Natural Resources member-led program at the Commonwealth Program. He is also a professor at Golden Gate University. So it's a real pleasure for me to introduce Carrie. He's been a wonderful help to us and very helpful for our programs. Carrie?
Thanks, Anne. And so it's a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to introduce Les Wong. Les is a native of Oakland. And after high school, he went to Gonzaga University up in Washington just sort of stayed in Washington for a while. He got his degree there, and then he got a master's degree at Eastern Washington, and finally his doctorate at Washington State University. Before coming to San Francisco State University, he was president of Northern Michigan University, which he tells me has worse weather than this. So that's shocking. Since Professor Wong, or I guess I should say President Wong, joined San Francisco State University, he has undertaken a number of initiatives. Most importantly, I think, is the strategic planning process that he led a collaborative effort there to put a strategic planning process in place that will lead to better outcomes. He's specifically interested in educational technology and assessing how good the programs are going. And I can tell you at Golden Gate University, those are the two big things, the technology of teaching and how are you doing, having some metrics and measurements to do that. At San Francisco State is a surprisingly active and diverse place, 30,000 students in 250 different degree programs, both undergraduate, graduate, and certificate programs. 30,000 students, very diverse population. It's one of the most significant urban universities in America. And so it's my pleasure to introduce Les Wong, president of San Francisco State University.
Well, good evening, everybody. I'm going to self-disclose something really, really quickly so that I didn't want the title of the presentation to lead you to believe that I'm going to only speak about environmental and sustainability issues. What I'd like to do is take a look at some key issues that have a lot to do with how we create environments for students to stretch and do a lot of serious thinking. So that when they have to confront not only issues of the environment and sustainability, but they take those same skills out to deal with a real myriad number of incredibly complex issues. And so if I seem to be rambling a bit, I worried much more about setting up the notion of the really wonderful efforts that we're expending and achieving and in sustainability, but truth be told, that's going to be at the end of my comments. And so the degree of my success will be if I thought out effectively setting up that discussion towards the very end. I do want to express my appreciation to the leadership and members of the Commonwealth Club, for this opportunity to address the complex issues of inquiry, controversy, freedom of expression, and activism. How these issues are faced by a large urban and diverse public university like San Francisco State University may offer some insight in how large, complex organizations try to effectively deal with issues not only of large scope and what we call big data, but also issues of social realities that often aren't big data and complex, but meaningful and quite deep and certainly important for the future. And a discussion about a number of the issues that we confront at San Francisco State might offer us an insight about a campus culture that really is predicated on social justice and active involvement that I think requires a different kind of patience and a different kind of commitment to the learning process. You know, we actually want our students engaged, and that alone can be a risky proposition. We don't want them sitting on the sidelines, unless they choose to be. We want them to make a difference in a lot of different ways, and I will get to that in just a moment. But we also want them to do a lot of good thinking along the way. I also want to thank the students, the faculty, and staff of San Francisco State for being both good teachers and good thinkers. And please don't define those terms by the relative positions of teachers and students, because some of my best teachers have been our students. And I think there's a humilité that goes with paying attention to every member of the university community. And I also want to thank my cabinet who showed up tonight. The only thing that would have prevented them, I think, would have been if game six, except for my provost, were tonight. So I want to thank them all for coming out to listen and share their thinking with the entire group. My cabinet, we have endeavored and tried really hard to mirror the best practices of being effective and being unafraid, to thinking about what's possible given the complexity of the challenges that come to us each and every day. And if you want that nice, peaceful existence of books and thinking and classrooms, that classic Oxfordian stereotype, you probably wouldn't come to San Francisco State University. And so that expectation of being out in the public is very special for us. And after having worked in four states at large and very small campuses, I think it's a very special part of our atmosphere that we do expect students to be active with their learning, to be out in the world. And we hopefully try to prepare them for that. And it goes without saying that I also recognize the good fortune and role that luck plays in our track record. But I still can't shake my own Midwestern sensibilities that good things happen to good people. And maybe that's the purpose of a university education, to turn out good young people. And our support for student engagement may, in fact, reflect our own sense of activism tempered by our many years in the academy. But tonight's thoughts, truthfully, are my own responsibility, and I take full charge of them. And please do not cast aspersions to my cabinet and employees and students at the university. Tonight is about my own thinking about creating a campus where difficult dialogues can occur. So let's keep in mind that a president stands at the nexus of important communities of learners and activists in a robust environment of protest and expression, especially in the lightning-fast world of social media, and especially in a city defined by political activism. Can a university president serve all these constituents. And should she? But this nexus also means we at the university must be clear and forthright about our most sacred and hallowed responsibility, the education of our students. And it is how these environments challenge and support our academic mission that I hope my comments today will address and provoke some thinking. So first, some context. I have found in my 3 years that there are many perceptions of San Francisco State, but setting up the context up front offers some context about my own observations of our students, our faculty, and the learning culture that exists at San Francisco State. As you heard just previously, our student body headcount is roughly about 30,000 students. In the Bay Area, I believe, only Berkeley is larger than us, although the other CSU campuses are growing very, very rapidly. I was told yesterday that San Jose State might be cracking 33,000 to 35,000 students. So not small campuses by any means. And there is mounting pressure for San Francisco State to grow. Probably the most surprising attribute of the campus in general is that for the 3 years that I've been on campus, we average about 50,000 applications each fall for about 3,500 openings. So just think of those odds, and it would not surprise you that we turn away a number of qualified students. But I will have to tell you that we have made a commitment to each and every qualified applicant coming from San Francisco Unified Schools. And so we made a deep commitment to serve the local school district to make sure that students in San Francisco have a place to go to a university, but more importantly, to go to a great university that is a player in so many different ways. So some specific things. 40%, or roughly 40%, of our students are first generation. That means that they're not only the first in their family to go to college, but if they persist and graduate, they are the first in their family to earn a college degree. I am convinced that they are the person who breaks the stranglehold of uneducated processes in a family, because we have collected some anecdotal data, and that student who's first in their family to go to college and to graduate sets the stage for brothers, sisters, cousins, nieces, nephews, and in a couple cases I've interviewed grandmas, grandpas, and great-grandmas and great-grandpas. The burst of college attainment after that first one is quite significant. I am still trying to talk a couple students into focusing their master's degree on taking a look of the social and family effects of first generation or first to graduate. 60% of our students are students of color, predominantly Hispanic and Asian American. 55 to 60% of our student body are women, and just under 40% of our students are Pell eligible students. And I'm assuming everybody knows that that is a sign of the financial needs of the students that attend San Francisco State. Our tuition remains among the lowest in America, and despite the low tuition, student debt still is an issue. Our diversity, both in students and employees, represents the future face of America today. If you look at the last two census counts, you'll find it very interesting. They close them with predictions about what's happening in terms of trends and in the future. And if you took a look at the demographics of the San Francisco State student body today, it is amazing that it reflects the prediction of demographers of America in 2025. We are ahead of our times. We are the face of America that will come down the Pike. Our students are street and culturally smart and educationally ready, and we make every attempt to remediate high school deficiencies by the end of year one with good success. So why is this important to tonight's comments about dialogue? And I have very egotistically called this Less's axiom number one. In order to own your own mind, live a meaningful life, and make a difference in the lives of your family, your community, and yourself, values and goals that I find terribly relevant to today's young people, there are habits of mind and behavior that need flexing, testing, adjusting, accepting, and often denying. Without a university experience, there will be few environments where in one's lifetime one can do all that mental lifting and social psychological adjusting in such a protected environment. Such is the personal benefit of going to college. And in such an environment, a lifetime of benefits can accrue. If you think about your own life, imagine telling your boss, were you not on a campus or you were figuratively at work, that you dislike what your boss has asked you to read. You have a different opinion, and you believe the institution is moving in the wrong direction. Okay? And that you are going to take over the CEO's office. It's just probably not going to happen too often. I tell students jokingly, you can have my office. Please don't break my bobblehead dolls given to me by the Giants. So, being serious again, axiom number two. All this flexing, testing, adjusting, accepting, and often denying requires a learner's willingness to critically engage, confront, process, and judge their own personal experiences. And the data are clear. This requires a community of faculty, staff, and mentors willing to push, pull, and shove students to think and learn in challenging, and I will say now, most importantly, respectful situations. A personal anecdote. I am an educational psychologist, Jesuit trained at the undergraduate level. My first theology course was about getting comfortable critiquing Christianity. That my professor was arrested often for critiquing the Vietnam War showed me how faith and commitment may require bravery. But it distilled in me an understanding of Christianity. He never asked me to join him. He never asked me to get arrested with him. He never asked me to believe anything. But he pushed me real hard to think better about the abstraction of peace, the reality of social justice, and the tenets of Christianity. And that is where universities, families, and communities can be both protagonist and antagonist. And it is in this special relationship between faculty and students, mentor and mentees, university institutions and student experiences that a level of skill and attention to life's intellectual challenges are confronted up front. And that is where the rubber meets the rocky road. And I do believe that if one doesn't learn how to confront life's conundrums and misunderstandings in the protected world of a university experience, I don't believe it will happen anywhere else. My argument about so much legislation regulating what colleges can and can't do is that it is an intrusion that fundamentally hinders a student from learning how to think on their own. Universities can be responsible for good and bad thinking, and certainly good and bad behaving. I'm not sure why or how we can hold that kind of experience to an accountable measure. But there's no clean path, and this is the case for PhDs, deans, presidents, elected officials, and as you all have read, even the Supreme Court. No one has a lock on the right path, and that is why university education is more about learning how to own your own mind than it is about job preparation. So let me dig a bit deeper. At the crux of a lot of this are the hot-button issues of free speech, tolerance, civility, and discourse. And I've been reading a lot of James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, and that alone can lead to some entanglements of their own. I don't think either gentleman imagined the lightning speed and scale of Twitter and other social media. So let's tackle the first issue, the First Amendment. And I was very pleased that a colleague, I do not know them, in the Midwest, teaches a course simply on the preamble to the Constitution and the First Amendment. But I'd like to read it to you. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. What a powerful commitment. And we have lived this creed with good success since the beginning. We have been challenged if the size and scope of the cases and publications addressing this are testament. I urge each of you to study the history of just one challenging issue in the First Amendment. And if you need help, I'll give you a clue. Think obscenity. There's a special case in the First Amendment, though, called academic freedom. A special case of the First Amendment affording college and university scholars speech protections when done in their main area of specialty or in matters relating to the governance and direction of their employer. I have been most intrigued by the University of Illinois case of Dr. Stephen Salaida, whose anti-Israel tweets cost him an appointment after being offered the position and then having it withdrawn. And I should say, in fairness to the board, technically not offered because it was not confirmed by the president or the trustees. And interestingly enough, the tweets lied just on the edge of his own expertise in world politics, especially in the Middle East. Second case, civility codes for language and behavior. There is now a growing controversy over the language of civility codes regulating speech and behavior on campuses. Such codes seem awfully prescriptive. And while I think of such behavior we now call bullying, I guess I think of the question of unprofessional behavior rather than bullying or being uncivil. But such talk now has a new issue similar to uncivil codes but closely related, and they're known as trigger warnings. And they are warnings placed on syllabi and course descriptions, warning students that some material may be threatening, hurtful, and that caution is needed. If you haven't studied trigger warnings and you're part of academia, they're actually quite interesting. Did you want to make an announcement, Dan? Okay. Does everyone know what they are? Okay. I'm going to shorten this up because what I have in front of me is the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors Code on trigger warnings that was adopted in 2014. And it really is kind of telling about the value of civil codes because it and triggers because it really gets down to what should students experience and to what degree should we have to warn them. And quickly, the closing paragraph. Some discomfort is inevitable in classrooms if the goal is to expose students to new ideas, have them question beliefs they have taken for granted, grapple with ethical problems, they have never considered, and more generally expand their horizons so as to become informed and responsible democratic citizens. Trigger warnings suggest that classrooms should offer protection and comfort rather than an intellectually challenging education. Trigger warnings, they reduce students to vulnerable victims rather than full participants in the intellectual process of education. The effect is to stifle thought on the part of both teachers and students who fear to raise questions that might make others uncomfortable. So, egotistically, axiom number three.
Brief rest. This is Ann Clark at the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Worldwide Challenges and Difficult Necessary Dialogues with Dr. Les Wong, President of San Francisco State University. And now we'll go to number three.
Thank you. So axiom number three. I'd like you to think about trigger warnings because they have a way of provoking a certain sense of righteousness. The effect by humanity to make sure that I own your mind is so pervasive and in key cases quite suffocating. The special responsibility of universities, and I dare say public universities, is to create those conditions where responsible scholarship and research are meant to broaden and deepen a student's perspective, not limit it. The ivory tower also has an unexpected benefit, metaphor intended. I would think that finding the right balance and structure of how the external community is allowed to be on campus and how they can insert themselves into the educational process requires my team to be vigilant. To say it a different way, we are struggling with the notion of keeping public politics off the campus, or the politics of highly specific action groups that aren't interested in teaching students as they are in developing blind followers. And that's difficult because we have no means of preventing public agencies from coming onto campus. So I'll tell you a little story that presidents often are good at telling stories. A colleague of mine videos most of the meetings with public interest groups so that these external parties with resources and networks don't have the exclusive rights to tell what happened in the meeting. Very few of us presidents walk in and pull out a camera and turn it on, right? And in today's world, I can't go to any student meeting without students picking up their phone and videotaping. My friend, it's a courageous move on his part. For example, we have wrestled with relationships between Jewish and Palestinian student clubs who have extensive outside support networks. And I am proud to say that we have worked closely and progressively with the Hillel and ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, as well as Palestinian community groups. I remember vividly the use of social networks that depicted how awful San Francisco State is, and I think we were actually listed as one of the most anti-Semitic campuses in America. When that report broke, Chancellor Tim White called me about a report of an identified conflict now happening on campus. And what did I know? Now, many of you don't know this, but I have this lofty office that looks right down on the student square. And I turned to Leisha's in the room, too. I said, Leisha, right, holding the phone, what's going on? My chief of staff is here as well. So I thought the best thing to do is look out the window and see what's going on. So I look out the window, and I do see students protesting formally, loudly, but peaceably. And that when their time was done, and I'm a psychologist again by training, it struck me that they walked off together to go have a meal, and I suspect have a bit of a dialogue. Now, I didn't know what to tell the chancellor. We have tried very hard to enable student leadership to have student control and student focus on issues. What I saw on the ground with my own eyes defied what was being circulated on social networks. And that's not to say that that bad stuff isn't happening. It is to say that community and national politics can interfere and denigrate the learning process for students by their intrusion into campus affairs. But I'm not smart enough because I don't see a solution coming anytime soon. All right. So the role of protest and speaking voice to power, I'd like to spend a couple minutes talking about sustainability and divestment protests on the San Francisco State campus. San Francisco State was the first major public university to commit to divestment from fossil fuels and tar sand companies nearly, Robert, almost 15 months ago, 16 months ago. Now, I have to tell you, I have some sympathies for that movement. But I'm the president, and I want them to think long and hard about their concerns. Because I know that students could have taken over my office. I'd have to feed them. They could have broken my bobblehead dolls. And they could have staged demonstrations. And it would have been easy for them to stir up thousands of protesters and arouse the news media. Sustainability issues are critically important to today's college student. And I think campus leadership who underestimates that affection is making a serious mistake. But I also knew that our students wanted to be heard and, most importantly, respected. So when the students came to me and asked for a meeting, I simply said, okay, let's meet. Let's air it out, and let's see if a win-win strategy is possible. And so I didn't go alone. I did have some courage, but I made Vice President Nava, who's sitting in front of me, go with me to the meeting because his unit interacts with our foundation. And it was a pretty tough meeting, respectful. The students did their homework. They produced an excellent argument. And perhaps the most telling piece that through my own sort of craziness, they kept referring to investment of their money. And I had to remind them that this wasn't their money. This is the money of donors coming in to the university to support a number of things. But we talked, and I said, you know what? I'm open to a proposal. I heard your good arguments, and my rule is your thinking and your work your own? And it's important to me that you produce a proposal that will be long remembered far beyond any amount of noise that you can make. And that your good thinking is much more important than the loudness of your voice. Put together a proposal, and my team will take it seriously. The students did put together an exceptional proposal, and I took it, as promised, to the foundation board. They, in turn, impressed with the work and dialogue, voted to endorse divestment and develop a socially responsible investment policy that Mr. Nava and the foundation directors are overseeing. That was over a year and a half ago, and the foundation has made great strides to reach divestment in a very short timeline. And we still remain one of the first large public universities to divest in tar sands, and we remain the largest public university to do so. And I'm proud to say that it is because of the quality of the student interaction and the quality of their work that reflected their own thinking. Now, is it over? Issues with students are never over. Not by any means. Those students that generated that initial proposal that led to a landmark decision, now there's a new wave of young students who have come to us and said, we want to push the thermometer even higher. And they would like for us to adopt the tenets of a national organization that essentially proposed that foundation funds and assets be divested from the top 200 companies, including the United States of America. Students adopted the national group's goals, their agenda, their scope, and now I have a significant issue. I simply asked them, in your proposal, what is you and what is the national group? And I think that, and Mr. Namba can offer comment in a moment, I think that if they had offered us a proposal that reflected their own thinking, as their predecessors had, we might have been much more open to listen to a complete divestment of our portfolio. But the speed at which the foundation endorsed the student proposal surprised many of us. And in fact, the speed at which the divestment process is operating with foundation funds continues to be a point of pride for all of us at the university. But the most important lesson, and it gets to the main point of my talk tonight, is that my commitment to listen to their own developed arguments became first. And in many ways, students coming first, in many ways, diffuses the kinds of behaviors and thinking that don't lead to progressive solutions to complex problems. And I think that students, because they were heard, and we told them, you know, you are setting a legacy that will be remembered for a long time. Their focus on good work, on good thinking, and developing their own thinking became paramount to them. And it would have really been hard for my team to say no to them. And so to import a copycat proposal just didn't strike me as good thinking. It certainly was good politic, but as I promised them, we will continue to work with these students and try to seek common ground. So in closing, I often tell students I will always meet with them. While I am convinced they want to be heard, I am even more convinced that they want to be remembered. And on a student on a campus where students come first and good and effective thinking is supported, I think effective dialogues can happen. Nothing on the campus has burned. Nothing has been destroyed. My bobblehead doll collection is intact. And my door is always open to students who want to think on their own to get something done. And I think and I hope that students sense that not only in me, but in the leadership team that is around me. And perhaps my own mentors long, long ago were right. It is about respect, and it is about respecting the student voice and being able to force yourself, train yourself, reinforce yourself, reward yourself for listening first and carefully to students. So I want to sort of stop there, and I know that the Commonwealth Club has a system for questions and discussions. Thank you, everyone.
This is Ann Clark at the Commonwealth Club tonight, and we are at that point in our program for our audience questions. And tonight, Carrie Curtis will dialogue with Dr. Wong in terms of the questions that have come to him, to Carrie now, to ask Dr. Wong and to respond to them. So we are in our question time mode.
Thanks, Ann. Freedom of speech, commentators have said that the Charlie Hebdo cartoons could never have been published today on many U.S. campuses. What about San Francisco State? You understand the question?
I do.
Okay.
I do.
Not to put you on the spot.
No, that really is a tough question, and I really do believe that students, their faculty, and our work with them would probably cause us to have a pretty serious discussion about not only the publication of the cartoons, but are they prepared for the after effects of that commitment to publish that kind of stuff, whatever it might be. And if that discussion is of a quality where there is that proverbial teachable moment, I really do think that students would probably not publish those pictures. We talk a lot about respect on campus, and I believe students would have made, and it's always hindsight, right? You can look back and say, well, they wouldn't have done X or Y or Z. But I really do think that after consideration like that, that students would have said there is a different way to get the message across other than such raw shock value. We talk a lot about respect for religions, for people. And on our campus, there is an affection for the weak, you know, the sort of underdog, and making sure their voice is entertained on that stage. And so that's a brilliant question. And I'm going to put it in front of students. That would be an interesting discussion, because in many ways, our student newspaper has printed and published things that probably rival the Hebdo characterizations.
Without such a big circulation, probably. Okay, so next question from the audience. Could you please comment on Governor Walker's proposal, Scott Walker, Wisconsin, to change university governance and the impact on academic freedom and the climate nationally for higher education? And I don't know what his proposal is, actually, but presumably you do.
He's actually made some inroads in containing academic freedom, and I believe he has gone through an effort for tenure and tenure review. And those are intrusions by government into some interesting areas. You know, the premise of my talk is that when you try to impose restrictions in speech without the input and consideration of voices at the table, inevitably you are going to have demonstrations of all kinds that include disruption and violence. I see those kinds of demonstrations as examples of not being heard, of not sensing that your voice is at the table. So I'm thinking, I think Wisconsin is the tenure and promotion stuff first. Now they're looking at containment of academic freedom, but I don't know the specifics on that.
Here's another question from the audience. Do you have any thoughts on the presentation of, quote, science and the negotiation of reality, close quotes, in the university setting?
You know, we've had great situations on campus where students and faculty and staff had just been unafraid to take a look at paranormal, parascience, quasi-science. What is science? Is science's role too big? You know, the whole effects of technology, Twitter, et cetera. And again, I think in that classroom where students can engage those ideas, however controversial and dangerous they might be, have a chance to think through on their own terms what those issues might mean for their behavior and the behavior of others. And so if I understand the question right, you know, the beauty of a liberal arts education, right, and a good gen ed education is that you get a balanced treatment to give a student the tools to think through, or at least try to think through, some very difficult things.
Earlier in your talk, you said that you put a higher value on the liberal education and the, I'm not remembering your exact words, but the liberal education and the teaching of habits of mind over vocational training or job training. Can you expand a little bit on that? Because that's an inherent conflict. At my university, of course, we're much more oriented to professional training, mm-hmm. and not so much the liberal arts kinds of things.
And I don't mean to denigrate the sort of technical job training that's going on across the country right now. The economic effects of the recession to today make it real. I mean, our students work 2 and 3 and 4 jobs to pay their way through school. They want careers that have some future to them to enable them, A, to pay off the debt and yet provide for themselves as they move forward. The hardest part, I think, for young people to get their arms around is the versatility, adaptability that a liberal arts education provides them. So when you, for example, there have been many studies of the Fortune 100, 200 CEOs and vice presidents, and by and large, the majority of them are liberal arts trained. They have used those broad and very clear thinking skills and other skills to help them solve problems, to get their think their way through things. The Isaacson book on Steve Jobs isn't so much about Jobs' personality as it was the range of thinking and the readiness of Jobs to think differently.
Think about, different.
About products. And to think different. And so if you're in school to get a job, that's terrific, but your education is going to be much longer than that. And I value the sort of adaptability and adaptability that a broader-based education offers a student, particularly in a world that shifts so quickly.
Right. When I think back on my undergraduate time at Berkeley, I was in a science-based curriculum, and so I didn't have a lot of liberal arts-type courses, but I had several of them. But when I think back on my learning from that time, what I value is the liberal arts stuff and social sciences, because that's what really changed the way I think. You know, differentiated equations, I don't know. I haven't used those too much lately.
You know, I like to tease my mathematicians friends. You know, the teaching of calculus 1 hasn't changed for like 300 years, right? But what's changed is how to apply the calculus. You know, and that's where good thinking takes a tool like the calculus, which is really hard to learn, and then opens you up. And now we have big data solving pharmaceutical issues that are really calculus-based. You know, analysis. I have someone very close to me who it still bothers me. He quit his doctoral program 4 months before completing it. And he and a bunch of friends in mathematics, he and a bunch of buddies got together, met a guy that said, the pharmacies can't do math. They'll pay us to do that. So he and these kids started a company that is now the largest IT company in New York City. And what they do is all of the mathematics for all of the pharmacy testing going on in the United States.
Wow.
And so they simply took the calculus and said, we're going to apply it to whether or not a company is saying that their drug works or doesn't work.
That's a fascinating thing. There's a bunch of research about the outcome of clinical trials and the effect on the outcome of the nature of the sponsorship of the research. If it's sponsored by a pharmaceutical company, those tend to come out in favor of the efficacy of the drug. Even though these researchers just swear, and I believe them, that they weren't consciously affected. But as a professor of psychology, I think you can probably...
You can work on that.
You can parse that one. Back to a question from the audience. Could you comment upon the recent Northwestern University Title IX case brought by two students who claim that an essay by a female professor created a hostile environment?
My legal counsel's in the room right now. She's ducking down below. You know, that gives you an idea of how complex the issue of expression and protest and issues.
Could you explain what that is?
The Title IX thing?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you give a little background on that?
Well, we have a question from the audience to explain. Yes, Kerry?
Yeah, the question is asking President Wong to explain the background of the previous question, which was the Northwestern University Title IX complaint by some students that a professor's article was created a hostile work environment, a hostile environment.
Sue, go ahead.
We'll have to just wait a minute for you to get the microphone.
So the professor published an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is widely read by faculty and administrators across the country, commenting on some sexual assault issues that students had claimed under Title IX, which, as you're probably aware, Title IX, although it covers and was originally thought of much more in sports, actually covers all of higher education, and more recently in the last couple years has been focused a great deal on sexual assault. And so she questioned whether this was really an appropriate application of Title IX. And in response to that, people began to sue her, and she was brought under scrutiny, and there was a lot of question about the academic freedom. So in the most recent issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education, if people are interested, she's written a follow-up response to that. She was exonerated by the investigatory body that came in and cost a great deal of money, actually, from several other campuses to take a look at this. And now she's worried about retaliation because she wrote this next article. So it's a kind of ongoing thing, as the president suggested. This freedom of speech is extremely complicated.
Thank you.
This is Ann Clark at the Commonwealth Club, and you are listening to our program, which has really looked at the worldwide challenges and the difficult necessary dialogues with Dr. Les Wong, president of San Francisco State University. We are coming close to that final question. And Carrie, do you have a final question?
I have. It seems like my mic isn't on. Is it on? I don't
think so. We checked and it...
I'll just talk louder.
Do you want to use this microphone?
So one of the things that a number of people came here to hear about from you is environmental stuff. And I can see this isn't working. So what is the state of environmental initiatives on the San Francisco State campus in terms of making the campus itself sustainable and using good environmental practices.
One of the reflections that I have about our effort in sustainability on all of our campuses has been the collegiality and input and broad input that our committee structure has to make sure that everybody with an interest has a venue by which their activism can be realized. And it's led to some really wonderful attainments. We met the governor's water restriction things long ago. We're planning to do a lot more on-campus work around sustainability. When you create structures that allow broad input, the scope of your effectiveness suddenly magnifies outward. The students have given me a proposal to get a transportation associate vice president on campus. But they tell me, I trust them, but I'll check it out, that we're the only campus without one. And now students have said if we get a transportation coordinator, half their job should be on biking and how to improve cycling to campus. And those are all wonderful ideas, but imagine how loud they would get if they didn't have a venue to direct positive action at. And so water use, the transportation, 70% of our students are on public trans getting to campus. We're trying to cut back on cars and parking. We're trying to get students to eat better. And so the sustainability initiative has a lot of food components, both preparation and accessibility. We're hosting a national conference coming up here in a couple weeks. I was just told Caitlin is in the room. Where are you? In the back. We have 800 people signed up, a number of presidents. The divestment will be part of it. But it is a broad scope, students heavily involved in it. And again, I just think it's, there's some part of me, that a good part of me, that believes that protests, particularly undesirable protests, is directly related to how many broken channels there are for students to engage. And if you build a system or create one where they are heard, where they can plug in, I think that noise turns into transformative action. And I think the sustainability effort at San Francisco State is just a terrific example of that.
Oh, thank you.
And Carrie Curtis, who has been with us tonight, and we're very grateful for Carrie to be here. He has one final question that's come to him.
Well, actually, it's a question from the audience. There's a young person in the room, a 13-year-old, I think. So I was wondering if you could actually ask the question yourself.
And we'll get the microphone to him right away. He's hiding. He's being shy. But you get to ask the question.
Hi.
Hi.
So, to be honest, in other people's perspective that I have met, that they went through college and you talked about this educational environment, but and also I took in the fact that a lot of people go to your university, and so the classes must be big, and I think the most effective way for a class to be like truly educational is, you know, it's very hard to do that in a very big class, but you need it to be big because it would affect the environment, the community, and a lot of other factors. But also another thing is a lot of the things that you said went over my head, so I don't understand that much. But I worry about a lot. The question was about how he would make that a very good educational environment in a huge space. And another thing is making good people, like, so they could get good things. A lot of the times, I think that isn't true, but I wish for that to be true, and I like the idea that you would want to make more good people.
I think you need to attend San Francisco State. Yeah, there's a lot of wisdom in what you've said. You know, one of our biggest issues is high demand, low space. And when you get into those situations, you make decisions about who can come and who can't and who can attend, who has to wait, et cetera. So I encourage you, what we're actually starting to think about is what can we do to get middle school kids onto our campus during middle school so that they start learning what it means to be engaged, to be respected, to be heard on a campus, so that your question is answered, that you suddenly not only understand what I'm saying when you're in sixth grade, but you're asking me tough questions when you're in seventh grade. And in eighth grade, you're asking me why I didn't follow up on the question that you asked me. But it's done in such a manner that by the time you're in 10th grade, you and I will solve a problem. We will create a better thing, whatever it might be. And so the whole purpose, I think, of opening up and keeping open our doors to the degree we can is that there is respect, and I think it leads to hope that the energy of a young person or a student, and I say young person, we've graduated people in their 80s with their bachelor's degree, but they want to be engaged in meaningful activity. And I think good universities do that, not just San Francisco State. Great question in the back.
Our program tonight is Worldwide Challenges in the Environment, Difficult Necessary Dialogues. This is Ann Clark at the Commonwealth Club of California. A big hand for Dr. Les Wong, President of San Francisco State University. Thank you so much. Thanks also to Carrie Curtis, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and one of our leaders in the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. And Carrie, as we mentioned, is a professor at Golden Gate University. So a big hand for Carrie for carrying our questions. Most of all, thank you to you, our audience, and those who had questions, and our young man in the room who asked his questions of Dr. Wong. It was really wonderful to have all of you, and we have enjoyed your questions and your being here tonight. Thank you to you, our audience here, and our audiences on the radio and the internet. Remember, you can find our programs at www.commonwealthclub.org, and you can access and download programs by clicking on the multimedia section on the Commonwealth Club website. Again, this is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 112 years of enlightened discussion, which is, I think, one of the cornerstones of your talk tonight, Dr. Wong, in the know, is adjourned.